Before Wi-Fi, LANs, DARPANET, Usenet, the Internet, the World Wide Web, Web 2.0, AVIs, MPGs, MP3s, Firefox, Internet Explorer, chat rooms, Chrome, BitTorrents, YouTube, PornTube, and cyber warfare, there was Paleo Cinema. Hi and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast. But before we go anywhere, as you might recall from the last podcast, I asked whether I'd completed my Magnificent Seven of Alternative Action Stars, and that I also offered naming rights to this podcast to whoever gave me some feedback telling me one way or the other whether I had or not. Our old mate Serps at the Land of Serps and Honey website told me I'd only done six of the seven. I'm going to correct that this podcast, but in the meantime, this is now, for this podcast only, the Serps Paleo Cinema Podcast. So thank you very much for the feedback, Serps. If you ever get down here, I owe you a beer. And I am making every effort now to make sure that I keep more copious notes on what exactly I have and I have not done as far as the podcast is concerned. I've got myself a very nice little notebook. Everything goes in there and the problem will not recur. Moving on, I am still recovering from my cold, so my voice sounds a bit odd today. That's the reason why. It is the end of winter and the beginning of spring here, and apparently the new office I work in has become a petri dish of various bacilli and viruses, some of which I caught, and they have knocked me low for a little bit. On the other hand, things are going better as far as depression's concerned. Moving on, getting things together, watching lots and lots of movies, and I'm going to share some of them with you. I did get a lot of feedback from the last podcast. People seemed to enjoy it, even though it had Audrey Hepburn in it. So I should do a shout-out to the usual suspects, Serps, Weaverman, Mondy Boy, and Mitch. Thanks for the feedback, guys. Also to Scott Snow and another number of other people who've said nice things about the podcast and given useful feedback as well. Serps did bring up the possibility of me talking about Mario Bava and a number of his movies in the podcast, and I sent him back a reply stating, basically, it's not something I particularly want to do. I do like Mario Bava's movies, and I think that they're well worth looking into, but there are a lot of podcasts out there that are already doing that. And one of the things I want to do with this podcast is avoid covering things that other people are covering. I think the important thing is for me to find my niche. And yes, I mean, please watch any number of Mario Bava movies. There's not one of them that's less than interesting. But for me, I'm trying to find the bits in between, the bits other people miss, the bits maybe they don't know about, the things that I like but are perhaps not as well regarded or as well discovered as some of the things that like Mario Bava, Dario Argento, Lucio Fulci, all those Italian guys, some French guys and a few other people. There are a lot of podcasts out there that are covering newer movies. And when I decided I did want to do a movie podcast, one of the things I really emphasized to myself was I didn't want to be tilling the same soil as everybody else. I'm looking for my own niche. I'm looking for the stuff that I enjoy. And from the sound of things, I'm looking for the stuff that other people are having fun discovering after I mention them. So that's basically it. Keep giving me suggestions, please. I'm not trying to inhibit feedback in any way or stop people from saying, hey, why don't you look at this? Please do. I will give serious consideration to any suggestions, but in a way I've got to steer my own course, and there's nothing to say that sometime in the future I might look at a Mario Bava movie or two, but it does kind of fall down lower on the priority list than some of the other things I've got to discuss. So thanks. Please keep the feedback coming. The email address is kultguru@gmail.com. And the website, in case you haven't spotted the website yet, it is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. And there's my other blog about science fiction films, which I really should do more things on. Skiffy Films, SKIFYFILMS. blogspot.com. That's my one for science fiction movies. But moving on, I've got two movies that are set in Africa to discuss this time, and one action film from the 1970s that I found quite enjoyable when I rewatched it.
Hey, man! Man, take a look at that. We're running into something.
How long has that been on? Gee, looks like one hell of a storm. It's covering the whole front.
Yeah, without a cloud in the sky. I've been watching. I'm telling you, man, it just come on up out of nowhere, out the ground.
Just climb a bit. Shouldn't give us too much trouble.
Man, look at that.
That ain't dust. What is it?
It's, I don't know. Yeah, it must be. Locusts, flying locusts. Miles of them.
Okay, that's from the first movie I'm going to talk about, Sands of the Kalahari from 1965. Like the other two films, they're basically two-fisted bloke movies. They're not for girls. They don't have Julia Roberts trying on dresses in them. They are pure male adventure films. It's my antidote for the Audrey Hepburn thing last time around, which I don't really need an antidote for, but I just thought I'd say that. Okay, the story. A plane full of people who were trying to get across Africa for their own various reasons. They were supposed to take a commercial flight, but the commercial flight was cancelled because the aeroplane broke down. So between them, they hire a small bush plane piloted by the guy you heard there talking, Nigel Davenport. And the plane is hit by a locust plague. The engines clog up and it crashes in the Kalahari Desert. Crashes on a sand dune, nothing in sight. Miles from anywhere, no chance of rescue because that part of Africa at the time didn't have a lot in the way of rescue things happening. And it's the story of the survivors trying to stay alive until some kind of rescue can be effected. And it is a kick-ass action film. I'll give you the cast as well, which is a quality cast. The movie was directed, by the way, by Cy Endfield, an American who worked out of Britain for a long time and did a lot of classic British B films that I kind of like, things like Hell Drivers. And then he went on to make Zulu, which became an enormous hit. And from there, about a year after he did Zulu, he must have liked Africa because he made Sands of the Kalahari, which is actually based on a novel by a guy called William Mulvihill. I have a copy of the novel and it's not a bad read. Not easy to find, but I do like it a lot. You've got Sir Stanley Baker, one of my alternative Magnificent Sevens. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to put this movie into the podcast. Stuart Whitman playing a white hunter called Brian O'Brien, who obviously his parents had no imagination. Got Stanley Baker playing an alcoholic mining engineer called Mike Bain. Harry Andrews playing a Dutchman called Grimmelman. Nigel Davenport playing the pilot. Theodore Bekele, an Israeli-born actor, playing an Indian doctor who works for UNESCO. For some odd reason, they chose a large Jewish guy to play an Indian. Who knows? And, of course, for the mandatory female, they've got Susanna York, an actress I like a lot, and who has a kind of thankless role in this movie in some ways. No, but I'll do the trivia stuff first. Trivia's always a bit of fun. Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor were going to originally play the roles that Susanna York and Stuart Whitman got, but for some reason that fell through. I'm pretty sure that was a good move. I really can't see Richard Burton playing a white hunter in exactly the same way that Stuart Whitman did with his barrel chest and his cut-off shorts. I looked on Internet Movie Database and someone said that the movie is kind of halfway between Flight of the Phoenix, the James Stewart movie from a few years before, and The Naked Prey starring Cornel Wilde, which is the other African movie I'm going to talk about today. The Naked Prey has just been brought out in the Criterion Edition, but I'll tell you more about that later. So, here's the survival scenario. The survivors find, in the distance, a pile of rocks, a small mountain, and they walk towards that carrying whatever supplies and things they can find. It's an arduous walk. It's about a 50-mile walk. They walk across the desert, reach the rocks, and find a couple of things. One is that there's a bit of food, mostly in the form of kind of paddy melons. There is a water supply, but they're sharing this large black rock in the middle of the desert with a large tribe of very feral baboons. And the baboons are the other character in the movie as much as the desert itself is. I'll just give you a little bit of an idea about what they say about the baboons in this movie. It's all quite interesting.
What about the baboons?
What about them?
Are they edible?
Eat baboon? Of course, people eat monkeys, but these are too human-like. They'll make me feel like a cannibal.
What do they eat?
Anything and everything. Vegetation, insects, even scorpions.
Do they eat those melons, cucumbers, and tubers you showed us?
Yeah, yeah, all of these, and many things we can't. They are better adapted than we are.
The hell are you? We're smarter and tougher.
In what way tougher?
I've got a gun, they haven't.
They don't need guns.
They do now.
Baboons with guns. That's a picture.
That's not so funny. Because I'm going to wipe them all out.
You would eat the meat from baboons?
No, but I'm going to shoot them all. If they eat what we eat, they're our competitors. You don't want to die here because some baboon ate what you could have eaten, do you?
The baboons would probably agree with your attitude, Mr. O'Brien. In this article I read, it says that the baboons are very warlike. They kill any rival without mercy. And they have a system of complete totalitarianism. There is a leader, a king, an absolute monarch. He gets the first choice of all the food and the females. And he can only be deposed if he is defeated by a younger and stronger challenger. Come to think of it, human beings are perhaps also not too much different sometimes.
Anyhow, you can't wipe them out. They are too intelligent, too fast. Once they see you can shoot them at long distance, they will keep out of range.
You will only exhaust yourself.
One of the gods of the Egyptians was a baboon.
You wouldn't want to kill a god, would you, Baba?
I suggest we save our energy and our ammunition.
It's not our ammunition, it's my ammunition.
Okay, so the situation is you've got a limited food supply, you've got baboons, you've got the Stuart Whitman character turning alpha male on the rest of them and deciding that basically the way to survive is pretty much to act as the baboons do. He manages to eliminate most of the other survivors in various ways and decides that he and the Susanna York character are going to stay there and live until something happens. I mean, I don't think he's very good at planning things. He has a couple of hunting rifles. He's doing okay at providing them with meat. And the Stanley Baker character, whose leg was injured during the crash, is slowly recovering and realizes what Whitman's character is up to and decides that he has to do something about it. And he has to get the Susanna York character on side so that he doesn't eventually end up the same way as a number of the other characters do. Now, I did find out a bit about the production of this film. It was 1965. It was filmed in Namibia near a place called Windhoek. And I found a copy of Theodore Bekel's autobiography, which oddly enough is called Theo. And he mentions a bit about the making of the film in there. There are a few things that caused him a few problems, one of which, of course, was the heat. Everybody hated the days when they were working on sand dunes rather than among the rocks where there was a bit of shade. At the time, Namibia was a part of South Africa. It was annexed by South Africa. But previously, it had been a German colony. So every time they went to dinner in the small restaurants that were in the town, all of the black African waiters spoke German, which struck them all as a little bit weird. There were some real problems with communication. But the biggest problem was with the baboons. They had a whole bunch of baboons, and to film them, they did things like they tied them down with fishing line to the rocks they were supposed to be sitting on, and of course the baboons were pretty pissed off with this. They're not known as the most easy-to-train animals in the world, and there was another problem. No woman was allowed on the set of the film if she was having her period. The baboons could smell the blood, and they would attack. So the producers went around to all of the women on site and just said to them, listen, if you're on the rag, don't show up and the baboons will go you. But that one day the teenage daughter of one of the producers turned up, and nobody had thought that a teenage girl could be menstruating for some odd reason. 1960s, people didn't talk much about that. And they nearly had the problem of a teenage girl being attacked and killed by basically a blood-crazed baboon. So if you're a woman and for some reason you have to interact with baboons, just be a little bit careful, look at your calendar, and try not to get bitten. But the baboons were a real problem for the cast and crew, and they got the baboon scenes done with as soon as they could, got them out of the way so they could concentrate on other things. When I was really watching the film, I kind of looked on it and thought, those poor baboons are sitting out in the sun, they're strapped down with fishing line, which is hard to see. Kind of adds a weird sensation to watching the movie, which is a good, solid action film. I mean, I've got to get back to that. It works really well. The actors are all incredibly good. There's a great scene towards the end with Nigel Davenport's character where he's trying to convince some people that he actually walked across the desert, and his total exhaustion and despair at the situation he finds himself in is a terrific bit of acting. I mean, his South African accent's not always totally on spot, but the acting in that part is particularly good. And the whole climax of the movie, which I'm not going to spoil, I'm going to tell you where you can find a copy of it. It's not out on DVD, but I'll tell you where to find it. The climax of the movie kicks ass. It's one of the best climaxes to an action film you're ever going to see. And it's totally unforgettable. If you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, there is a torrent site now. The reason I'm giving out this torrent site is basically because the movie hasn't been re-released by the people who own the rights. They probably don't even know what they've got. So if you go to Cinemageddon, that's Cinemageddon, or cinemageddon.org, I'm not even going to try to spell it, but cinemageddon.org, it is a site for BitTorrents. You do have to sign up to get access to them, but they've got a lot of things there which for whatever reason have not been released commercially, and therefore I think it's a fair go to say, use it if you don't mind downloading torrents. If you've got a moral objection to that, of course you're not going to. But that's the only place I was able to find a copy of this film, and I've been wanting to find it for a long time. And I was always willing to pay for a copy if I did find it, but that didn't happen. So the movie is Sands of the Kalahari. Check it out if you can. I'll put a link to Cinemageddon on the blog. And I really recommend that if you're interested in 1960s action films and a movie which I don't suppose remaking would provide any benefit, but check it out. It is a good, solid action film. The budget wasn't enormous, but the actors were good. The scenery is fantastic, and the plot moves along at a great pace and gives you a kick-ass ending.
I was just thinking, remember that fishing trip that you and me and your father took up to Canada? You was about 8, right?
7 or 8.
You fell overboard. You couldn't swim. Your old man says, he'll learn pretty fast. You were flopping around. You looked like a drowned rat. But you didn't say a word. You didn't yell for help or nothing. You just kept looking at your old man. And he didn't make a move. Well, pretty soon I had to reach out and grab you by the hair and pull you in the boat. You look like a drowned rat. Your old man, he laughed like hell.
That was a long time ago.
Okay, the second movie I'm going to talk about is The Mechanic, a 1972 action thriller directed by Michael Winner and starring Charles Bronson and Jan Michael Vincent. Now, Charles Bronson's an interesting actor. He couldn't act very well. Yes, he looked great, very dynamic. He had a really great villain's face. In fact, in Italy, moviegoers called him Il Brutto, meaning the ugly one. Yeah, he had what they call in Australia a great head for radio. In the movie, Bronson plays a character called Arthur Bishop. I'm not sure why they wanted to have a Charles Bronson movie where he has the name of Arthur, but it doesn't really suit him. Arthur Bishop is a hitman. He's a very high-paid hitman for a mysterious group of criminals who give him a little dossier every time he has to do a job, kind of like Peter Graves got at the beginning of an episode of Mission Impossible. Anyway, one of the people Bishop is contracted to kill is a very old friend of his who, as you heard in that first bit, knew his father. Now, this character played by Keenan Wynn is called Harry McKenna. And Harry's ne'er-do-well son, Steve. See, everybody in this movie's got a really ordinary name for some odd reason. There's Steve, there's Harry, there's a Louise, there's Arthur. They didn't go all out with the names on this one. But anyway, his son Steve is a kind of nihilistic, sociopathic, 20-something, rich kid. Asshole, basically. The kind of guy who, if he was around net these days, would be Stupp and Paris Hilton. Steve gets fascinated with the mysterious Arthur Bishop after his father dies, not knowing that Arthur Bishop was responsible for the death of Harry. He decides that he's going to investigate a little more and finds out that Bishop is actually a mechanic, a hitman, and convinces him to take Steve on as an apprentice. They do a few hits together. They go over to Italy for a very rushed hit on a particular person in Italy where there are some nice scenes around Naples. The movie moves towards a climax. I won't spoil the ending, but there's a twist ending on it, which is not particularly a big twist, but is very well done. There's a few interesting things about this movie. Originally, the character of Arthur Bishop wasn't going to be played by Charles Bronson. It was going to be played by Cliff Robertson, who, if you're old enough, you'll know that he won an Academy Award for playing Charlie Gordon in Charlie, the movie based on Daniel Key's Flowers for Algernon. If you're not old, you'll recognise him as being Uncle Ben from the Spider-Man movies. Great actor. One of the first movies he did, he played Moondoggy in a Gidget movie. So, guys had a pretty much of a big arc there in his career. But he would have been an interesting choice, but for some reason they couldn't get Cliff Robertson. And so Michael Winner, who had worked with Bronson previously in a movie called Chato's Land about a year earlier, decided that they would go with Bronson. The Bronson-Winner partnership lasted a number of years. They did three movies together, Chato's Land, The Mechanic, The Stone Killer, before they really hit gold with Death Wish and its four sequels. So this is The Mechanic is two movies before Death Wish came along and prove that a revenge movie formula works really well. You can even do it in 2007 with Jodie Foster in the Charles Bronson role. I like the Mechanic. The first bits of it are really interesting because for the first 16 minutes of the movie, there's no dialogue. It's purely Arthur Bishop going through the task of getting his dossier, reading about a hit, working out how he's going to do it, breaking into a flat to prepare everything he needs for a hit, which is slightly more complex than it needs to be really honest with you. There's a couple of aspects of it which are a bit unnecessary. And performing the hit itself. But the way Winner directs it and the way the script covers it, it's fascinating to watch this guy doing things which ultimately are really nasty. But, you know, it's the movie thing about specialist knowledge. One of the things that works really well in a movie is seeing an expert at something doing something really well, particularly if that something is out of the ordinary. It's like all those scenes in a James Bond film where you see him do some preparation where he's putting together a piece of equipment and you're not quite sure what it is, but you know it's going to be something cool when he finishes it. We have a fascination with that, and the visual medium of film conveys it really well. And there is a bit of this in The Mechanic which makes it work really nicely. The actors, so, I mean, Charles Bronson plays Charles Bronson pretty much. There is a lot, they attempt to put some depth to the character. He does suffer severe anxiety and his only real relationship is with a prostitute played by Bronson's real life wife, Jill Ireland. And there's a really great scene of him interacting with her, which is very uncomfortable in a lot of ways. but I think with a more nuanced actor, the scene would have worked a lot better. But nonetheless, it does play well. And Jan Michael Vincent, he was never a good actor. People might remember him from the Airwolf TV series. He didn't have a lot beside long blonde hair and a smirk. And nonetheless, this works well for the particular character he's playing. I mean, he's playing basically an empty rich kid who doesn't give a shit about anyone and thinks he knows everything. Ultimately, events prove that he doesn't, but they didn't probably need somebody more complicated than that. It's kind of a young Brad Pitt role, in a sense. Could have been more than it was, but, you know, it works kind of well. There's a lot of really nice architecture in the movie. There are some great houses in the Hollywood Hills decked out in 1970s Playboy philosophy decor that looks really cool, to be honest with you. The houses are lovely. And the scenes set in Italy are quite pretty too. And there's a lot of action, a few explosions and things like that. The movie is cooler than the sum of its parts. If you just focus on the acting, yeah, I mean, getting Keenan Wynn in there was okay. Seeing his death scene was fine. Jill Ireland does some interesting stuff with a small role as the prostitute. The guts of the film is how all of these things come together. The memorable bits aren't the characters. The memorable bits are the actions. And I suppose, given the limitations of the actors involved, that's probably a good thing. Now, Charles Bronson's an interesting character. He was in movies for about a dozen years before he really hit it big doing The Magnificent Seven. Before that, he did a lot of episodic TV. He played a mute servant in The House of Wax in 1951. He had his own TV series in the late 1950s called Man with a Camera, where he played a photojournalist who helped the police out a bit. One of the weird things I found out while I was researching this is when Charles Bronson was a struggling actor in the early 1950s, his roommate was Jack Klugman, the guy you know from The Odd Couple. So I'm just trying to picture The Odd Couple with, instead of Tony Randall, you've got Charles Bronson and Jack Klugman. These guys actually did that in real life when they were both, you know, jobbing actors in New York looking for a gig, trying to make a living. So that would have been rather interesting to see. The two interacting, two totally different kinds of actor, but both of them destined for bigger things in their future careers. When I first saw The Mechanic, it was back in the early 70s at, I think it might have been the Regal in Liverpool, where I grew up. And it was the days when I was watching movies like Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, and all those kind of, a lot of blaxploitation films, and just tons of B fodder. And this one fitted in well with that. It was pure action. There wasn't much complexity to it, even though the script allowed for the possibility of Arthur Bishop being a complex character. It doesn't really play that way in the final result. It's very much in that theme of 70s action films. Some of the action sequences have dated pretty badly. There's a scene with a shotgun and some mafia goons who attack Steve and Arthur when they're in Italy that doesn't play as well as it would in modern choreography. The fight choreography of the shotgun battle on a mountainside in Italy doesn't really come off as well as it would if it was in a modern film. But it kind of works, you know. Charles Bronson goes bang with a shotgun and some Italian guy throws himself against the wall of a cliff. It kind of, you know, it dates a little bit in that regard, but the non-action scenes are interesting. And so it kind of pulls the movie slightly out of the usual run-of-the-mill fare of the time. It was almost like they were trying to make a better film than they made. And you can see the efforts to do that that don't always come off because, of course, of Bronson as an actor and Jan Michael Vincent. But I like the fact that they tried. And the fact that they tried makes it a more interesting movie. It is on DVD. Pick it up, take a look at it if you choose to. I'm going to actually go back and look at a few more Charles Bronson films. I've got a few on DVD that I haven't watched for years. things like Mr. Majestic, which is based on a novel by Elmore Leonard. I'm going to check out that one again. Bronson's not particularly a favourite actor of mine, but I think his movies are of their time, and for that reason, and because I did watch them a lot when I was younger, I may revisit them at some stage and just see how I've changed since I first watched them. So that's the second movie, The Mechanic, 1972, starring Charles Bronson, Jan Michael Vincent. It was written by a guy called Louis John Carlino, and it was directed by Michael Winner, who these days is famous in England for being famous.
That was very untidy, Mr. Bishop. We'd like to know how Harry McKenna's son figures.
He'll be working with me from now on.
You think this is wise?
You telling me I need your permission?
Information is all I want, Mr. Bishop. We like to know things. An organization survives only because its members are willing to sacrifice certain personal choices for the good of all. A very democratic principle, Mr. Bishop. We survive because we have this rule. What you or I want is unimportant. Only the rule.
Someone trained by me could be of value to you.
Nobody lives forever.
Okay, movie number three. It is The Naked Prey, starring Cornel Wilde. It was made in 1966. Now, Cornel Wilde did a movie in 1948 called Roadhouse with Ida Lupino. It's just come out on DVD, and I'm picking up a copy very soon. But the reason I'm mentioning that is that Ida Lupino and Cornel Wilde both were studio contract actors who went on to have kind of underground careers as movie directors. Ida Lupino directed a number of movies in the 1950s, and in the 1960s, so did Cornel Wilde. He made three major films. I mean, he also did a lot of the direction on The Big Combo, a movie I mentioned in a previous podcast. But the three movies he made in the 60s and very early 1970s were Beach Red, which was a war movie he made, very strange war movie with lots of flashbacks and voiceovers, which were the thoughts of soldiers in the middle of a battle and all sorts of weird things like that. It's a very unusual but very strong war movie. All of the three major movies that Cornel Wilde did are very kind of violent and also graphic for their time. He made Beach Red, The Naked Prey, which is the best and most famous of the three, and he did No Blade of Grass, a post-apocalyptic movie based on a John Christopher novel, which was made in 1970. Oddly enough, it starred Nigel Davenport, who was also in Sands of the Kalahari. But today I'm going to talk about The Naked Prey. This movie is simplicity itself. The script was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Screenplay. The writers of the script were two guys called Clint Johnson and Don Peters. And dig this, the script was 9 pages long. There's not a lot of dialogue in this movie, and most of the dialogue there is are certain native tribesmen speaking in their own language without subtitles. So I'll read the synopsis that we've got on the notes to the Criterion edition. In the film, Wilde plays a safari guide in 19th century Africa whose hunting party is captured after his bombastic client insults the leader of a local tribe in typical colonialist fashion. Each of the men is tortured and killed in elaborate ways before Wilde's character, whom the tribe view honourably, meets his fate, which is to be stripped of everything, given a short head start, and then hunted down by the young warriors. Now, this sounds like something that somebody would make up, but actually it's based on a true story. Different setting, but a true story. John Coulter was a trapper and guide for the Lewis and Clark expedition in America, crossing the country. He was captured by Blackfoot Indians in North Dakota and escaped naked after a lengthy pursuit. Now, on the DVD box of this Criterion edition, they've got Paul Giamatti reading an account of what Coulter did. So now I've decided I've got to get this DVD because I want to hear the audio of this unusual story. So, in a sense, it's based on a true story, but for budgetary reasons, Cornel Wilde and his production team decided that they were going to make it in Africa, change the setting, but essentially tell the same story, which indeed they did. And this movie kicks ass. It's probably one of the best 5 or 6 adventure films of the 1960s. It's stripped to basics, indeed, as the character is. and it works really well. And one of the there are a few strengths to what Wilde has done with this film. The first one is it's a culturally sensitive film. He treats the natives on equal footing with his protagonist. Yes, they're hunting him. Yes, they're trying to kill him. But as people, they matter. And it's shown that they do in this film. It's a very, very graphic film for its time. I mean, the deaths of the other people in his expedition are quite nasty. One guy gets feathers covered all over him. He's hobbled and hunted down like a turkey or some kind of chicken or something by the women of the tribe. Another guy is hogtied, basically, put in front of two burning logs, and in between the two burning logs, the tribal people heard some vipers and cobras and things, so he gets stung to death, bitten to death by the snakes. And another guy is covered totally in clay and cooked on a rotisserie, which is really probably the nastiest of the three deaths that you more or less see in this film. But the majority of the film is Cornel Wilde's character, who is never named, he's just called the Man, fleeing these African natives, who are quite impressive. I mean, they're not wusses by any means. They're used to hunting, and the only head start he gets is as far as an arrow can be shot from a very primitive bow. So once he runs past that arrow, the first of the tribesmen is allowed to follow him. When that tribesman runs to where the arrow falls, the next guy follows him. So there's a kind of relay effect of these tribesmen attempting to capture and kill Cornel Wilde's character. That's it. That's the story. It's as simple as that. And it plays out. Everything plays out based on that. That's a dead simple plot.
Window.
The film is riveting. It's only very recently I've seen a widescreen version of this. And before that, it was pan and scan. I saw it on television. I saw it a number of other ways. In fact, I also had a copy at one stage in the 60s of the Gold Key comic book based on the movie. And it's a bit like, I don't know, having a comic book based on another film very similar, Apocalypto. Mel Gibson's movie Apocalypto is pretty much the same story. It's cribbed basically from The Naked Prey. And that's one of the things that movie makers do these days. They think that people don't know old films. Therefore, they feel free to basically iterate them. And everyone talks about how wonderful they are. Even a lot of film critics and film reviewers aren't familiar enough with the history of film to know what they're reviewing and whether what they're reviewing is indeed stolen from some other source. I'll just play a few bits from The Naked Prey and give you a bit of a feeling for it. All the music, by the way, is either tribal chanting or drumming. There's no European music in the film. So I'll just give you a little bit of that now. One of the other things I should mention in this film is how good Cornel Wilde is in it. He was never particularly one of the top-ranking movie stars of his time. But in this, where the man himself is kind of pared down to a raw minimum of humanity, oddly enough, it's probably the role of Cornel Wilde's. It's one of the most human ones. There is a point where he meets up and travels for a little while with a young African girl. and the relationship he has with her. Very touching, and it's a nice kind of breathing space from the constant pursuit. In a sense, it's another aspect of the film that humanizes the people who are, at least to the minds of 19th century Europeans, lesser beings. And I do enjoy the fact that even in the 1960s, even though this was filmed in South Africa, which was going through the immense horrors of apartheid at the time, that Cornel Wilde was permitted to make such an even-handed and humanizing movie, which portrayed black Africans as human beings, where it would have been very easy to make a film where they were basically less than that, in the same way that a lot of the early Westerns portrayed Native Americans as less than human, as savages and monsters. So all credit to Cornel Wilde. I think his movies are being reevaluated now by a lot of people who are into film, based on the Criterion release of The Naked Prey. Those of us who saw it at the time it was around have an immense fondness for it, and people were asking, why the hell isn't this thing on DVD? It's one of the best movies of its time. It's a one man's unique vision of filmmaking and of storytelling. Why wasn't it released before now on DVD? And the people at Criterion, who seem to be saving film culture single-handedly almost, have now released it. And while it's not the cheapest DVD to buy, it's definitely one for which I'm willing to pay out the money now that I know that there's a good edition out there. I did download the torrent, but against what everybody says about people who download torrents, I will be buying a copy of it as soon as I can get the pennies together. Very simply because it's a film worth having an original of, and the extra material that the Criterion edition brings to this film, the commentary track, the extra material with Paul Giamatti explaining about the original story upon which it's based, that value added means that it's well worth getting a full copy rather than just the film itself from a torrent. So in a sense, the torrent's a taste of what ultimately people will have as far as this film's concerned. And if you can't afford the movie, you know, download the torrent and watch it. You may well find that you do want to save up and get the film itself. But I recommend this one highly. In a sense, it's a perfect, if I was doing a double feature, this film and Sands of the Kalahari would go together perfectly. Thematically, they're similar. Totally different viewpoints on the same problems of survival in an African wilderness. But I think both of them, where native people are portrayed, and they are portrayed in both films, they show a heartening amount of humanity towards people who historically haven't been treated as well as white people have. So see it, and if you can afford to, buy it. It's definitely right up there. Okay, the last of the Magnificent Seven alternatives that I've been working on since Jesus was playing Cowboys. Okay, I'll go down the list and I'll add the last person to it. We've got Burt Lancaster, Lee Marvin, Rod Taylor, Richard Boone, Jean-Paul Belmondo, Sir Stanley Baker, and last but not least, Woody Strode. Now, for those of you who don't know who Woody Strode is, check out Spartacus. The black guy that Kirk Douglas fights in the arena is Woody Strode. He started out as a football player in the 1940s, and they basically broke the color bar in football by him and another guy becoming a member of the team. Before that, it was only white guys. He was born on the 25th of July, 1914. His full name is Woodrow Wilson Woolwine Strode. He was 6'4" tall, and he died on the 31st of December, 1994. I think he may well have been one of the first people, or at least the first black actors, who was an actor-turned-athlete. There were white guys who did it beforehand. Buster Crabbe was one. Johnny Weissmuller was another. But very much, he was a forerunner of a lot of black action stars to follow. Let's see. The other guy who he broke the color bar in college football was a guy called Kenny Washington. He worked with John Ford a lot doing westerns. There were, of course, Sergeant Rutledge, where he played the title character, Sergeant Rutledge. He was in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. He did a lot of other good films too. TV episodes of shows like Daniel Boone and Batman and Tarzan and those sort of things. He played an Apache chief in Shalako, a western starring Sean Connery, which is quite an amusing one to watch. And basically, he was such a great presence that I had to have him in the alternative Magnificent Seven. Yes, he appeared in The Professionals, along with Burt Lancaster. I really like the ensemble that I've put together for this alternative Magnificent Seven. I think it's be interesting to see how some of these actors would have interacted with each other. There aren't all that many of them that are still alive. Let me have a look at my list. Two. Rod Taylor and Jean-Paul Belmondo. Only two of them left alive at the moment, which puts them one up on the real Magnificent Seven because the only one of those left alive is Robert Vaughn. So there you go. Lee Marvin was in The Professionals as well. Maybe next time I did this sort of thing, or if I had it to do over again, I'd kind of say, okay, people who weren't in The Magnificent Seven or The Professionals or The Dirty Dozen, maybe I can rethink that and fix it up at a later date. But there you go. My alternative Magnificent Seven, Burt Lancaster, Richard Boone, Rod Taylor, Jean-Paul Belmondo, Sir Stanley Baker, Lee Marvin, Woody Strode. Now, I'm tempted to do as my next project a modern Dirty Dozen. So let me know what you think about that idea. I've already got a few of the actors written down on a piece of paper. So if you want me to do an alternative modern Dirty Dozen, which kind of goes along with Quentin Tarantino's current project for remaking Inglourious Basterds, drop me a line. And if you just want to talk to me about movies, if you want to have a chat about the podcast, kultguru@gmail.com. Now, this is looking like it's going to be one of the longest podcasts I've done. I like that. I wanted to eventually get them up towards an hour anyway. And that's pretty good, given the fact that my throat's been aching all the way through this one. I will be back in 3 weeks with totally different movies. I might want to stray back into science fiction if I can find some stuff I want to talk about. I will catch you guys in 3 weeks. Goodbye.